I am really delighted and honored to be here. I'm a Yale School of Music graduate myself, master's in composition in 1974. And I love the idea of an intimate gathering like this with students and people who I assume are classical music fans from the area and some highly distinguished musicians. I also am not crazy about talking from a stage, but I like that I can see you clearly from up here. If I sat down there, it's kind of nicely informal, but I don't see you so well. So I'm going to try to be brief, which is kind of rough with a subject like the future of classical music, because it's a big subject, and so much of what's necessary, I think, is necessary to talk about it is not very well known, which is an interesting problem in itself. Anyway, to give you a brief outline, and I'm going to talk about a lot of big subjects, and I'm going to rush over them, and I admit that there are subtleties and other points of view and contradictions and quite a lot of things that I may not be able to touch on, but there's a question period for that. And also, I'm here through the night, so we can talk till 6 o'clock in the morning. Well, I think all of us may have better things to do, but I am here. So basically, I'm going to talk about the situation of classical music now in a very cold-hearted, statistical way. I'm going to talk about what classical music was like in the past, which is really dramatically different if you go back, for example, to the 18th century from what it is now. I think more dramatically different than I ever learned when I was in music school. And it's really only the past 10 years or so of scholarship that has uncovered some of this stuff. And I'm going to talk about... what? You would think I would know this even though I'm... Oh, the cultural gap that I think exists between classical music and the rest of our culture now. Then I'm going to talk about what can be done and what is already happening. I think change is very much underway. When I've talked about these things in the past, I have to say that sometimes there is a generational difference in the response. That is, people my age, and I freely identify my age as over 60, you see the color of my hair, people my age tend to see a civilization that they grew up with and are comfortable with and love passing away, and that's not easy, and it is passing away. In fact, it probably has passed. Younger people usually feel right at home because you all are members of the civilization that has already come in. But I remember a really fine gentleman, a lawyer from a Middle Western city who's chairman of the board of his local orchestra, who said once in a private orchestra gathering that he thought everybody in the orchestra business should undergo grief counseling. I don't know if it's that bad. And his orchestra pulled things together, so I'm not sure he says that anymore. But things are not good. So I'm going to start out with the really dire part, which is statistics. And I want to ask all of you the interesting question. How many of you can tell me what the trend has been in orchestra ticket sales and where you got that information? Tick trend for the last 10 or 20 years. Anybody ever seen those numbers? You have not seen those numbers because those numbers basically don't exist. The opera community has fairly good numbers about how they're doing. Chamber Music America does nothing. Any data I've ever gotten is anecdotal from individuals who run chamber music series. Presenting organizations, they don't keep this information. League of American Orchestras, what they have is utterly pathetic. It's useless. Fascinating to me because... let's take other industries that are known to be in a fraught condition. The American automobile industry, newspapers. Well, for every American newspaper, we know what their bottom line is, we know what their circulation is, we know their advertising sales from year to year, but we in classical music do not have the basic numbers that would describe our situation, and I think that this is really bad, and it's a sign of a great immaturity and lack of worldliness in the business, and is one of the many signs, I would say, that classical music is not actually in touch as an organized enterprise with reality. I know that that's a strong thing to say, and One of my good friends is marketing director of the New York Philharmonic, and he's as in touch with his reality as anybody could be. But the business as a whole, okay, one exception, the top 10 orchestras in the country keep the most scrupulous statistics for their ticket sales, and they don't want anybody to see them because it doesn't look good. I was shown them, it was something like something out of a spy novel. Somebody invites me to dinner. He has a sheet of paper. Will he show it to me? Maybe he will, maybe he won't. Finally, he does. I can't have a copy. I cannot take notes. Really, it's not spy novel stuff. And basically, it was like that from 1990 onward. I think there's an uptick in the last few years because they realized they were in trouble. So we don't have the stats that we need, but the National Endowment has been studying what they call participation in the arts since 1982, and their most recent numbers are really something. In 1982, 13% of American adults, when surveyed as part of the 1980 census, said they went to classical music concerts, performances apart from schools, school events. 1992, 12.5%. 2002, 11.6%. 2008, 9.3%. That's a decline of 28.5% since 1982. Now, there's some more to say about that. And the first thing is, if 28.5% fewer people are going to classical concerts now than in 1982, why is not the classical music business in wholesale panic? The reason is the population has increased, okay? So the actual decline numerically is only 1.something%, I calculated. So I put that on my blog, and immediately I get email from a guy who used to run one of the big five orchestras, and he says, oh, come on, it's much worse than that. Everybody in my business knows it's much worse than that. And these figures are general, they're self-reported from the people who were talked to, and they don't zero in on something that might be much more sensitive, like ticket sales, subscription ticket sales to orchestra concerts, which probably are a more restricted audience than the people the NEA is surveying. And also the NEA is surveying people who went to free concerts. You know, maybe if they went to a classical music concert, it was the 4th of July, you know, in their city park. It's when you break this down by age that it gets even more interesting. The numbers for younger people, their participation, they tanked since the 80s. In fact, the percentage of the classical music audience under 30 dropped in half between basically in the 80s and the 90s. The numbers that just went down for the first time are people from 45 to 64. Those numbers used to be fairly constant every year. Now they're tanking, and the only age group in the population that still goes as often as they did are the people who are over 65. And the reason for this is actually very easy to understand, especially when you know what I've learned about the age of the classical music audience over time. It used to be dramatically younger. So, when you talk about an age group, it's a moving target. Different people are in the, say, 45 to 54 age group now than were in 1982. So, the people now, where did I write this down? The people now who are 65 and over, between the ages of 15 and 20, that was 1958 to 1963. The classical music audience still had a median age of around 30, believe it or not. And so younger people went all the time, and so they got in the habit of going, and they keep going. Now, people 45 now, they were 15 in 1979, they were 20 in 1984. They grew up at a time when it wasn't common for young people to go. And people who are 30 now, who grew up in the 90s, just forget it. They are really not probably ever going to be any large part of the classical music audience. By the way, footnote to everything I say, unless things change a lot. So what this would predict is quite a notable decline in the size of the audience in the future once this group decline in age group participation continues and starts not being offset by population growth, which would seem like it would happen. A German scholar has done research with similar data in Germany, concluded the German orchestra audience will decline by 36% in the next 20 years. If that happened now, goodbye 52-week season, goodbye full-time employment for orchestra musicians. It's a serious stuff if it happens. A word about funding. Funding is a tricky subject. There are no scholarly papers, as far as I know, on orchestra funding, but some things are known. It's interesting that if you go back to the 1930s, 70 to 90% of orchestra income came from ticket sales. That's now down around 25 to 35%. Constant decline. Metropolitan Opera made a profit in the 1920s. They could have been a business. And the decline of this over the long time was predicted by an economic law called Baumol's Dilemma, which I won't go in now, but you can look it up. It applies to all economic activities that are not engaged in production of goods and don't show productivity gains. Universities, hospitals, and orchestras are the classic examples, and you understand how the cost structure of all of these has been hit. And if there are fewer people interested in going to classical music, surely there are fewer people interested in donating. And in fact, most people's experience with younger donors is that younger donors are scarce. So that's something else that ought to impact the business over the next couple of decades, which will not be pretty if things don't change. So, the age of the audience. This is original research on my part. It's not as if I had to go very far to find it, but it just wasn't known. I've heard from so many people, classical music audience has always been middle-aged. This is a good thing. It's fine. People get to be 50 years old or so, they start going to classical concerts. It's how it's always been. People say this. And I used to believe it because I liked these people and I respected them and they ran big institutions. Then I started asking, okay, so-and-so, who runs one of America's largest orchestras, you say every tracking study orchestras have ever done shows this to be true. Can you show me those studies? He says. I think when I came to my orchestra, the publicist then said there was such a study. I don't actually know. I actually knew that publicist. She's somewhere else. I emailed her. She said, didn't say that. There are no such studies as far as I can see. But I have, starting with a book I found by chance in the Juilliard Library, found that there are studies, although I've read in print that these studies don't exist. Studies were done of the classical music audience in the past. I know three. 1937 is part of a major study of American orchestras. They weren't particularly interested in the audience. They were interested in financing, but they found out that two orchestras that they studied, Grand Rapids Michigan Symphony and the LA Philharmonic, median age, 28 of the orchestra of the audience in Grand Rapids, 33 in L.A., primary occupation, housewives and students. 1955, the Minnesota Orchestra, then the Minneapolis Symphony, hired a major firm to do a serious survey of its orchestra. It found out the median age was 35. Half the people who came to concerts were under 35. And they said, I just read the study, they said, and if you take out the 23% of students who come, if you look at the professional people, it's still half of them are under 35. You have to go to the housewives and the businessmen. That's what the four classifications they made by occupation. Students, professional, housewives, businessmen. The housewives and businessmen is two-thirds, only one-third of them were under 35, which, needless to say, you would not find now. And in 1966, 20th Century Fund, a major foundation, did a large study of all the performing arts, found the median age of the audience to be 38 across all disciplines. And if you actually read the study, they are fascinated by this. They say the dominant characteristic of the performing arts audience is its youth. And we now have to determine why older people stop going as they age. It's a different world. I don't have as thorough numbers for later decades until the 80s. For the 70s, I have fragmentary things that show that the aging appears to have been underway. The NEA has been studying the age of the classical music audience and has found it to be increasing from 1982 till now, from a median age of 40 to a median age of 49, although major institutions find their patrons to be quite a bit older. Remember Peter Gelb at the Met saying their subscribers had a median age of 65 when he came in. And what I hear privately from orchestras is actually younger than that, but not old. So it is not normal in the history of classical music for the audience to be the age it is now. It is probably a sign of classical music moving away from mainstream culture so that the people who go most are the people who were sort of socialized into it at a time when younger people were. One objection people say is, oh, the population is getting older. And yes, I will address this one. The population is getting older, but the orchestra audience in the past, based on this data, was not all that much older than the median population age, and now it's far more old in relation to the median population age. So as the National Endowment has been saying every time it does one of these studies, the classical music audience is aging faster than the population. Seems to be a fairly established fact. But it's when you look at the anecdotal data about audience age that it really gets cute, when you find out what it meant to have a younger audience. For example, I take these stories from the study of American orchestras where I found the 1937 audience data. Back in the day, MIT students in Boston would decide they would go to the Boston Pops. So they would form a line in the street and they would snake dance from Cambridge over the bridge into Boston and go to the Pops. Harvard students would come and they would make a nuisance of themselves. If they make a lot of noise, they would demand to hear the academic festival overture because it had a student drinking song in it. And they wanted that at their concert. Needless to say, doesn't happen. Now, Geraldine Farrar, the opera diva and silent movie star, had a following of teenage and 20-something girls who used to come and cheer for her and faint when she sang at the Met. And it wasn't uncommon, actually, for opera divas back then to have followings like that. Hilary Hahn in her blog has a lovely story she saw in a movie about Heifetz. He comes to a California university to give an impromptu concert, and it's in the warm weather and students are all out on the lawn, and somebody comes out and says, "Attention, everybody, Heifetz is giving a concert." Everybody jumps up, runs inside. And finally, if you know E.M. Forster's novel Howard's End, written and published in 1904, there's a lovely scene toward the beginning, which is really quite famous for a number of reasons. It's a family and friends going to a concert, and on the bill is Beethoven's Fifth, and Forster does a beautiful job describing how everybody listens, the teenager following with the score, the older person is tapping her feet to the rhythms, the woman in her 20s who's inventing a whole scenario about goblins, which is actually one of the best analyses of the symphony I've ever read. But it just paints a picture. He doesn't say, oh, how weird, look at this. All these kids are going to the symphony. It was just what you did, and the piece was very familiar to them. You could multiply this with references in movies, but I don't have time, so I won't. Classical music in the past. Some of the stuff is really surprising, and it leads to the thought in my mind that since classical music has changed so much in the time that the repertoire we know has come into existence, that it could easily change again. And for those of you who are the classical musicians of the future, I'm not saying you have to do everything that these people did in the past, but it certainly could be an inspiration to do some things differently. Maybe, and some people have tried. But to be very quick about it, one of the differences is in the audience. Pretty much through the first half of the 19th century, the audience, and particularly in opera, but before the 19th century, also in instrumental music, they talked during performances, and they clapped whenever they heard anything they liked. They clapped, for example, at the premiere of Beethoven's Ninth during the brief timpani solos in the scherzo. They liked them. They never heard quite anything quite like that. So ripples of applause immediately. They clapped after the cadenza of Brahms's Violin Concerto when Joachim played it at the premiere. Henry Fogel, who used to run the Chicago Symphony and the League of American Orchestras, put a beautiful story up on his blog about a concert by a 19th century violinist whose name I've forgotten and is not a name I know, but he's playing a concerto of his own composition. And there's the orchestral tutti to introduce it. And then he comes out on stage and the performance stops and the audience cheers him and applauds him. And he's dressed to kill. He's wearing a cape. He's drop dead gorgeous. And finally, when they stop applauding him, then he goes on playing. Plus, a beautiful story that Verdi was reminded of in his old age. You know, he's now very, very advanced in years, but somebody says, do you remember, Maestro, the premiere of Aida in Parma in 1872? And they got to the third act, and the baritone sang, rivedrai le foreste imbalsamate, le fresche valli e nostri templi d'or. And the audience went nuts, and they interrupted the performance, and they screamed and they shouted. They wanted an encore of that phrase right then, and they wanted Verdi to take a bow. And Verdi said, yes, I remember, and I love it. And isn't that better than the silence the Germans are imposing on us? I want to go back to those days. But one of the best evidences is a letter Mozart wrote about the premiere of his Paris Symphony to his father. It was the first time he'd ever been away from home without dad, and it's his first major premiere on his own. And he writes, I can quote it, can paraphrase it very well from memory. He writes, I knew that there was something in the first movement that they would like, and so I made sure to repeat it, and I made sure to end the music with it, and the movement with it. And sure enough, when they heard it, they all burst into applause. So you have the great Mozart knowing that audiences do this and planning his pieces to make it happen. But the last movement is even better. He says, in Paris, and I learned this in music history, and he encountered it in practice, in Paris they pride themselves on beginning their pieces with a coup d'archet, a big stroke of the bow in unison. He says, so we do the same thing back home, he says. So I started my last movement with only the violins, piano. And when they heard that, they all said, shh, 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 because it was new. And then after eight bars, when the tutti comes in, they all applauded because they got the joke that had been played on them. In my classes, I actually take the Paris Symphony and I analyze it not as a piece of sonata form, but as a piece of entertainment. I'm convinced that Mozart, not only in those movements, but throughout, knew very well what the audience reaction was going to be and planned for it. And once when I was hosting a concert series with the Pittsburgh Symphony and programming it with them, we did the first movement of the Paris Symphony, and I read the letters, and I told the audience to applaud whenever they wanted something, and the results were, whenever they liked something, and the results were fascinating. Number one, the applause varied. They really heard different things at different times. Lustiest applause in the recapitulation where it diverges from the exposition. I don't think these people knew sonata form, but they heard something new happening. And most interesting fact, that they stopped applauding when something new happened so they could hear it. So that kind of disposes of the idea that if you did this, at least in repertoire designed for it, that you would obliterate the music and nobody could listen. Okay, so audience reactions. And you know, it got worse. Baroque opera, forget it. This was uncivilized by our standards. Richard Taruskin, in his 5-volume history of Western music, compares it to families at home watching TV. People came to the opera in the 18th century to watch. And by the way, just a digression about that briefly. I sometimes in my classes bring out the CD box for one of the series of Vivaldi operas that is being put out on the Naive label, which are very, very, very sexy. And I ask if this is appropriate for classical music. And, you know, the usually kids think it's kind of cool. But the reason it's especially appropriate for Baroque opera is that Baroque opera was a living, walking, breathing sexual scandal, especially Vivaldi. The following reasons. Number one, you all know how Vivaldi taught in a school for girls in Venice. This is, if you know Vivaldi's biography, you know that. I once read a detailed study of that school. Venice was a wide open city. And those girls who were the rejected girls of noble families, many of them snuck out at night and worked as prostitutes. Vivaldi, after he left and started going around Europe making his major career, took two of them with him, and he lived with them. And you can believe that people in the 18th century drew exactly the appropriate or inappropriate conclusion that we would draw. And finally, the leading singers in 18th century opera were castrated men. Okay. Number one, it was illegal in Italy, where they all came from, to castrate a boy so as to develop his singing voice. So every one of them was a violation of law, and they all had cover stories. Oh, so sad. When I was 10 years old, a goose pecked me right down there. Not true. They were sold by their parents to music schools. Number two, they were sexually potent, and their tastes ranged widely and tended to include both men and women. They were safe as lovers because they couldn't get anybody pregnant. They were walking sexual scandals, and anybody who went to the opera in the 18th century knew that and probably knew who in town the leading singer was reputed, male and female, to be hanging out with. Vivaldi, meanwhile, led the performances from his violin and specialized in playing higher and faster than anybody else could, just stopping the shows dead with his solos. It was really wild. It was the Wild West of music. Does anybody know, by the way, to go from the salacious to the sublime, when the term classical music came into being? Does anybody know that? Anybody want to take a guess? Okay, classical music as a term came in around 1800. Why? Because for the first time they started performing music from the past. Before that, they didn't. Everything dropped away when its style went out of business. And that's why Baron von Swieten in Vienna, with his collection of Handel and Bach, absolutely amazed Mozart, Haydn, and Beethoven, who didn't know that music existed, because it just wasn't done. So the 19th century brought a sea change about that. There was great interest in antiquity, great interest in keeping alive the music of our great masters, Mozart and Haydn, and Beethoven, who was still alive, but was kind of the cusp of this and the man who embodied the new artistic idea. Previously, a great book by a man named Jennings, I've forgotten his first name, called Listening in Paris, Study of the Audience in Paris, from the 17th century through the 19th century. He says that up to the 19th century, music was considered to be a minor art on the level of, very 4th of July here, fireworks. Wasn't considered to be profound, wasn't considered to be deeply expressive. And then in the 19th century, and the reason was because it didn't have words, it couldn't say anything specific. In the 19th century, 180-degree turn, now music is sublime because it can express the inexpressible, and the word classical music came in to talk about serious music as opposed to that junk Rossini is writing in the opera houses and that crap Liszt is playing until he got serious and Paganini is playing in his recitals. So somehow eventually, as the 19th century developed, it all began to be amalgamated. But originally, you know, classical music performances were by amateurs. You know, like Vienna Philharmonic would play five times a year and Johann Strauss's waltz orchestras would play 150 times a year and were far more professional. So performances, there used to be a great deal of improvisation and a great deal of ornamentation. And I think we know this. And if you study early music, you run into examples of it, and you learn how to do it. And sometimes in the opera house, you'll hear a 19th century opera with a little bit of ornamentation. Pretty amazing when you study how much of it was done. German orchestras in the 18th century, apparently all the violinists ornamented their first violin part independently of each other at the same time. We know this because they were condemned by many people. They were condemned so much you figured it was really widespread, and probably it was not a really great idea. Beethoven was an amazing improviser, and there's one lovely story. He's playing an early piece of his for piano and winds, and there's a fermata in the last movement, and he gets inspired, so he starts improvising. And the audience is really loving it, but the wind players are not loving it because they don't know when they're supposed to come back in. And they keep thinking, oh, God, he's come to the end, and they pick up their instruments and bring them to their lips, and then he doesn't stop. So finally he stopped. Pianists preluded. Before each piece, they improvised an introduction and between pieces. This continued into the 20th century, and probably the last person to do it was Wilhelm Backhaus. And you can hear him do it on a recording of the very last concert he ever gave in 1969, 2 weeks before his death. He has to substitute one of the Schumann Fantasiestücke for Beethoven's Opus 111 because he's not feeling well. And he begins with this lovely improvisation that leads into it. And it's like at a formal meal where you clear your palate with some sorbet or water or sparkling water before the next chorus. And it just puts you so much in the mood to listen. I was very struck when I heard that, how much sense it made, and of course, how beautifully he did it. For Italian opera, there's tremendous amounts of documentation about what was done, and singers left entire roles with written down how they would actually sing them, as opposed to how they were composed, and it was perfectly well understood. Maestro Rossini, when he wrote this, well, a perfect example from the modern day. Maestro Rossini, when he wrote his opera Semiramide, wrote the title role for his wife, who was no longer young and couldn't sing high notes. So it's a very low role. When Joan Sutherland revived it in the 60s, she didn't transpose it up. She just rewrote parts of it, which is exactly what they did in the 19th century, because you were singing it now. Here is a very nice example from an aria from Bellini's Norma. It's written. And Giuditta Pasta, who created the role, sang. And you know what? If you didn't do stuff like that, you were just considered crude and the composers would think you were crazy. Why would you sing it the way they wrote it when you could do something beautiful and individual on your own? And an interesting result of that is some 19th century operas like the Barber of Seville became repertory pieces. And if you went to hear them in successive seasons, different people were singing them, so they'd actually sing different notes. And it would be part of their dramatic conception of the part, and it would be really fresh. And in some bel canto operas, you will see long, long formal duets where somebody sings for 2 minutes, then somebody sings exactly the same thing, but it wasn't in that time the same thing because they each rewrote it differently. Finally, even into the 50s and 60s, classical music performers were far bigger personalities than most of them were now. You can see on YouTube an Italian baritone named Gino Becchi singing the Toreador song from Carmen. And the man is an animal. I don't think there's anybody like him even in rock and roll today, the way he dominates the stage with his voice and his gestures. He is 1,000 times larger than life. And there's a movie where you can see a lot of this called Carnegie Hall, which was filmed in Carnegie Hall in 1946 and has performances by a breathtaking array of classical music stars from the time, Artur Rubinstein, Ezio Pinza, Gregor Piatigorsky, a whole host of distinguished conductors leading the Philharmonic. So here's a revelation. Piatigorsky playing the final piece on a recital. He does a transcription of The Swan from the Carnival of the Animals, and he's accompanied by 6 harps, played by gorgeous women. So they were not afraid to be showmen. And the man, was as great as any cellist has ever lived. Gorgeous, aristocratic, refined. He plays this thing surrounded by the beautiful women. You cannot believe it. And you know you're in another world. But Artur Rubinstein playing the piano. I mean, he dramatizes the music with his hands, not because he's showing off, but because this is how he feels it. And then you see these people offstage, and they have dramatic scenes sometimes. And you really see this, they were big and they were accepted by the public as stars. And I'm not a big fan of formality in classical music these days, but I think I am back then because the way they played and the way they carried themselves to wear white tie and tails was not ridiculous. They really deserved to look like that because of what they gave. You can, get the movie on Netflix or rent it or buy it and you can see. Okay. The cultural gap today, I'm probably not being as brief as I should be. I think this is a really big subject. Cultural gap between classical music as it happens inside the classical music world and the culture at large. It would follow from the aging of the audience, and I don't mean to write off everybody I see here who's of my own approximate age and say we've all fallen out of the culture, but naturally, there are differences, and younger people think and act differently. Some quick snapshots about how I think this works. Dana Gioia, who used to be the head of the National Endowment, gave a commencement speech at Stanford University sometime in the last few years, which circulates widely on the internet. And he views with great sadness the fact that classical music is not on network TV anymore as it was in the 50s. Of course, network TV isn't what it was either, but anyway. And he talks about how wonderful it was when you could see Robert Merrill singing opera arias. So I, as a really hardcore opera fan, say, Robert Merrill, one of the world's most beautiful voices. No brain. Not an artist. Didn't really have much to offer compared to the likes of a Tito Gobbi, let's say, to name somebody of that time. But mainly, you come now, you turn on TV, you might see Bruce Springsteen, a man who writes his own music, writes his own lyrics, is a serious cultural figure, has a point of view on America now, which his music is, that's what his music is about. I'm not sure that we've taken steps backward. I'm not sure we haven't taken steps forward. We have to understand that popular culture has long since developed its own forms of art, and it's too late now to talk about the arts as the repository of meaning, and only if the arts are taught in schools will people be able to express themselves and be creative. Fascinating book called Engaging Art, co-edited by William Ivey, who is a speaker and consultant who deals with a lot of these questions, and it deals with the arts and a young audience, and everybody beats around the bush and everybody says, oh, I don't know, they're not the way they used to be, maybe we have to change. And one professor at Swarthmore says, oh, disaster, too many people are creating art, we have to stop them every way we can. I couldn't believe that one. And then you read the one chapter by people who've actually bothered to go talk to teenagers, and the stuff that these kids are into is just amazing, the kind of arts that they are spontaneously creating on their own. And that's what I think we have today, particularly, I mean, music is my field. In pop music, we've never seen such an outburst of creativity. Routine for kids in high school to be in bands, write their own songs, and then the ones of them who do it professionally, a lot of really good stuff, and the best alternative rock is these days rather hard to separate from the music that young classical composers are writing, many of whom have bands anyway, so they're doing both. This is a big shock for people in the arts, and people still talk as if the arts and popular culture have no relation to each other, and we have to sort of bring the world around to the arts or we won't have meaning or creativity. Classical music now has to coexist with popular culture and make its claim to do something that, just as Latin music does things that indie rock doesn't do, classical music does things that jazz and country music don't do. And I would say, a big topic, that the two for me are, first of all, history of Western culture. Classical music is intimately tied up to that. And if people are going to be reading Tolstoy and Dickens and Jane Austen and looking at paintings by the Impressionists, it's really a shame that they're not listening to Beethoven and Debussy. You would think it just would go along with that, but something has happened and it's dropped out. And then secondly, that classical music is a kind of music that's composed. I mean, there are exceptions, because some is improvised these days, but it's composed and it follows an arc the way a novel or a film does over time and develops. And that is a terrific thing. Doesn't mean music that doesn't do it isn't worthwhile, but classical music is fairly unique in doing that. And it's a shame, too, that that's dropped out, and that we've lost a generation of intellectuals and scholars, not just average people. I mean, you could invent a character who I'm sure exists, I probably know her, a graduate student in cultural theory who can, read Finnegan's Wake and tell you everything that it's about, and has no idea of any classical piece of classical music at all, and is listening to indie rock. I'm not saying that she's uncultured, but it's kind of a shock. So, second snapshot, You go to a classical concert, you hear a bunch of old music, and I'm not putting down the masterpieces, which I love very much, many of them, but it is weird, actually. If you went to theater a lot, I once went on the internet and looked at what regional theater companies do. They're doing half plays by living playwrights. And let's go around the world and listen to the sounds. I mean, listen to public radio. Listen to WNYC, the public station in New York. And they have talk shows during the day. And the theme music for all of them is something with a beat, because that is the sound of current culture musically now. Doesn't mean that music that doesn't have a beat from the past or present is worthless, but it is odd that you enter the classical music world and you don't hear a beat hardly at all, even in new pieces, although composers in their 20s are changing that big time. But it's just amazing. You enter the classical concert hall and you're just no longer in the contemporary world, I think, even when contemporary music is done. Museums are not like that. Art museums are far more contemporary and have adapted far more better to the present day than classical music institutions do. And finally, I would say that the classical music world is getting very bad at saying why you should come to a concert. What is going on? You know, the New York Philharmonic is going to play Beethoven's Fourth Symphony tonight. Let's say Glinka, Ruslan and Ludmila Overture opens the program. Maybe there's a concerto by a new composer. So what's actually happening, and why do we want to hear that performance of Beethoven's Fourth? What kind of piece is it, and what is this performance going to be like? You know that they're not saying that. You can read their publicity material and their marketing material, and they're not saying it, so it's not very surprising that people don't go. Or they say, oh, the New York Philharmonic, I would love to go sometime. I like classical music. Why am I going to go this week? I don't know. What are they doing this week? They're playing classical music. Next week, too. And if they differentiate it, they might say, oh, we have the new critical edition of the Bruckner Seventh. But that is not going to play out in the wider world. Meanwhile, if you follow pop music and somebody has a new album, you know exactly what it's about. It's about this point in their life and that point in our culture. And people can say why they would want to hear it or why they think they would not want to hear it. Okay, what to do? Let's see if I can breeze through this, although in a way it's the most important part. Many people think that music education is the answer, and I really beg to differ. It is true, maybe, that the existing classical music audience had some music education when they were young. I don't think it's a cause and effect relationship that then they became interested in classical music. I actually think it probably worked the other way, that the whole society was interested in classical music, so naturally they taught it in schools, and naturally people started going to hear it. But in any case, if anybody wants to think that if we reinstituted classical music education on a broad national scale, as perhaps they've done in Venezuela, that that would change things, I have three considerations. Number one, won't that take a generation? And if the numbers I cited are correct, don't we not have that much time? Number two, with so much competing music around, why are people going to become interested in classical music to the extent that past generations were when it's not their music? They have their own music now. And number three, which I think is the real killer, if you define the problem as the society not being interested enough in classical music, why does anybody believe that the political will and the financial wherewithal is going to suddenly materialize to change this? It seems to me it's a living contradiction. If we're not that interested in classical music as a society, I don't think we're going to institute music education on a widespread scale. So I think we have to do it ourselves, which is really much better because we can become entrepreneurial. And we can go out in the world and do things that people will be interested in. So I think there's a lot of hope. And number one, the business is already changing. And there are so many examples, and they have never been cataloged. So nobody knows what they are. I probably know more than many because I'm sort of a point man for this, and people call me up and they tell me, you know, or they email me, I did this, I did that, or did you know that XYZ happens? But I'm going to give you some just snapshots again. The Hamburg Philharmoniker, the orchestra in Hamburg, Germany, celebrated its most famous composer, Brahms, by playing the Second Symphony from 50 different places around the city. The musicians, divided into groups of two, went to 50 different places. They were on video, they were recorded. Their music director, Simone Jung, and with Marin Alsop, she's certainly the most furthest advanced of any woman in the conducting business. She got up at a famous tower in the center of town and conducted the whole thing. She could hear it on audio. Somebody mixed it. You can go to the orchestra's website. You can see this. You can see her conducting. You can see little windows with the 50 pairs of musicians. You can click on one of them. It blows up. And not only do you see them, you hear them. So if you want to hear the bassoon parts, you can click on that and you hear the bassoon parts. It's pretty cool. And it's educational on top of that. And it's a stunt. I don't say that this takes the place of performing it in a concert, but it certainly makes the city of Hamburg aware that there's an orchestra which is sort of cool and is interested in doing the kinds of things that are done in contemporary society. San Francisco operas had tremendous results screaming their operas live in the baseball field. And, you know, 20, 30,000 people come to hear it. I would think every classical music orchestra organization should be doing stuff like that, getting out in the community as much as possible and making the biggest stir you possibly can. It doesn't mean that everything you do is aimed at that. It doesn't mean that you don't do an old Webern program for an audience of 50 really committed people. It doesn't mean you don't do Mahler's Ninth and you say to everybody, nobody move during this. This is profound music that takes you to the root of your souls. This is not like when we were in the baseball stadium. This is a whole other thing. But you just have to get out in the culture and show that you're like everybody else. The Phoenix Symphony, Michael Christie, who later got in a lot of trouble as music director, but his first concert there as music director, he stood outside the hall with the members of the orchestra, and they said hello to everybody in the audience. I think it's just a beautiful thing. I've done a lot of work with orchestra audiences, and they are just so hungry for recognition and knowledge and a chance to ask questions and a chance to know what's going on. They really appreciate stuff like that. The River Oaks Chamber Orchestra in Houston, not exactly well known except in Houston, where all their concerts are broadcast on public radio, just finished their third or fourth season. The woman who founded it used her contacts in the Houston Junior League and in her church to build a strong subscription list. They perform at the church and they offer child care. Concerts begin at 5. You bring your kids. You go to the concert. The kids are taught one of the pieces. They come out to the balcony. They listen to it. They sing some of it for everybody. Then they go back. They have child care and kid activities. And then the parents go out and have a night on the town, come back, pick up their kids at 9, or they go later. Just a beautiful and simple idea made possible through the church connection, because the church already had child care. There are so many things like this being done, which I think are beginning to change the face of classical music in our culture, which is a good thing. I don't think it appears stuffy. I don't think it appears elitist. It just appears to be another kind of music. And if you look at the way it's used in commercials, it used to be used for things like Grey Poupon Mustard to show that it was a high-class product. Now you just use it because the tune sounds good. I think is actually better. And then finally, you guys, the students, you certainly are the people who can change things, because if I say there's a cultural gap, and if there really is, between mainstream culture and classical music culture, you all live in both worlds. At least that's my experience of the students I teach. So why can't you find the ways to bridge the gap in ways that I couldn't predict, and you might not be able to predict right now? And actually, a lot of it is happening. But I think one of the biggest imperatives you have is to reach an audience your own age, to figure out how to do it. I am a little tired of music schools who do outreach to the community and will send you into minority communities to play for kids. I'm not saying that's bad. I think that's great. But the challenge of reaching people like you is one that's not being even thought of, to my knowledge. Although I do have a project at the University of Maryland over the next 2 years where we're going to try to do it, which should be pretty interesting. You also have to begin to articulate the reasons why people should come and hear you play. When I teach at Juilliard and Eastman, that's always the final assignment, and it's so simple. It's take a piece you play and you love and talk about it so anybody would be interested. And some of the things that people say are just breathtaking, and they're all different when they really talk from their hearts. I mean, the scholarly kid, the cellist at Eastman, who talked about playing one of the Beethoven cello piano sonatas and using a facsimile of Beethoven's music as his part, his manuscript as his part, and what he learned from that. When he talked about that, that wasn't scholarly. You just were on the edge of your chair. Or the violist who talked about playing Beethoven Opus 74 quartet at Tanglewood with an ensemble that was thrown together and they hated each other. And this is going to sound as sentimental like as a romance novel, but she was not that kind of person and she meant it. She said when they hated the first violinist in particular, and when they rehearsed the slow movement, the music was so beautiful it brought them together. When she said that in my class at Juilliard, as a graduate student, our hair just stood up on end. And we really then tried to think, if this really happened, how do you talk about it? What images can you have on your posters and flyers? How could you communicate that this is what that music did for you and could do for anybody else? This is a wide open field. People have really done very little saying what this music means for me. I have some stuff that I assigned to my classes that you can read, and I can tell you how to find it. Finally, I'll end with this. I'm afraid I've talked longer than I meant to, but I was asked to come to the National Orchestral Institute at the University of Maryland and talk to the students twice at the beginning of June. Jim Ross, who runs that program, the conductor, he wanted the students to start making concerts their own way, and he wanted me to prime the pump. So I said some of the things I'm saying now, and whatever. I gave them a lot of examples of things that have been done. And they started writing down the things they wanted to do. And then they did them. They ended up playing a concert of new music that involved a Leon Kirshner string quartet, the Elliot Carter Eight Etudes and a Fantasy, the John Adams Chamber Symphony, which they played without a conductor, by the way, and with nobody coaching them. In fact, they had to learn all this music themselves without anybody helping them so that they could get experience putting things together. But they could also add anything they wanted. So suddenly added to this is a video introducing the Kirshner about how the kids rehearsed it, made by the kids. Cartoons showing along with the Adams because he based it on cartoon scores. A concert of their favorite rock music, played with an ensemble of bassoon soloist, marimba, double acoustic bass, and guitar, with a special Michael Jackson tribute added at the last minute because he died that day. They threw Billie Jean together really successfully. And then a whole improvised component that they invited the audience to join in on. And I'm not going to say that every concert should be like that. What I will say is that when I talked to the students afterward, what they loved was that they were being able to bring their two worlds together. And they were able to put on a concert, and Jim gave them full control. He didn't say, I'm going to censor what you can do. You just do what you wanted. He just said, try to make sure it has something to do with the music. They told me that they felt, for almost the first time, that they were themselves in playing classical music. I don't say, by the way, that all of you are radically alienated and you may not have realized it yet. It's completely up to you and everybody's mileage differs. But many of them did say that and they loved the chance. And the biggest surprise for me was the Elliot Carter piece, which I thought would stick out like a sore thumb as being so contemporary music. And it came right after the rock things, but it didn't at all. They had so much fun playing it, and they had so much fun introducing it and describing the compositional elements in each of the etudes. And then they played those things with such a great sense of enjoyment that the audience began applauding spontaneously, and they were just, the whole concert hall was wreathed in grins, I think because everybody had loosened up some. So, you know, over to you. Maybe, I don't know whether anything I said made sense. I see some of you smiling, I see some not, I don't know. It's really your ball game now. I'm addressing myself to the students here. Your ball game and your future, and I think you can do wonderful things with it.